Welcome to Irregular Climate, where we take a look at the irregular climate in our atmosphere and the irrational climate of global warming denialism. On this episode, German nukes, safety nukes, underwater nukes, and jelly nukes. Another pseudo-scandal in a teapot. The true cost of gasoline, greenhouse gas emissions reach record-breaking levels, and the weather goes berserk while crazy deniers predict an ice age? The disgusting harassment of scientists, Christy Crocks, the Kyoto Protocol is finally dead, and a delicious dose of irony. I am Dan Mutal. You didn't think we were done talking about nuclear power, did you? Yep, there is more to talk about. And this time, I'll try not to put my foot in my mouth. So, what else is there to talk about exactly? Well, how about the important difference between no nuke and no new nuke policies? The disaster at the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan has scared many people away from nuclear power. In some sense, this is understandable. The continuing nuclear disaster in Japan is truly frightening. Things are worse than we were told, and we now know that three of the reactors at Fukushima have suffered full meltdowns. Things are bad, and they will stay bad for a long time to come. But as I said two episodes ago, while nuclear causes calamities when it goes wrong, coal causes calamities when it goes right. And coal goes right a lot more often than nuclear goes wrong. The bottom line, at least for me, is that we have backed ourselves into a climate corner, and it would be irresponsible to take nuclear power off the table. At least sensibly, most people who are against nuclear power are against new nukes. There is some sense in this position, the point being that instead of spending money on new nuclear power plants, we should be investing in things like wind, solar, and geothermal energy. Renewables, in other words. But also remember that no one is considering building old, outdated nuclear power plants like the ones at Fukushima. What nuclear proponents are advocating is building new power plants that take full advantage of the technological progress of the past 40 years. And, like I said two episodes ago, I think most of the time, renewables will be the more sensible option. But occasionally, nuclear power will work better. So, no new nuclear is at least somewhat sensible. But what is not sensible is the no nuclear power at all position. In other words, no new nuclear power plants, but also dismantling all of the existing nuclear power plants. Surely no one respectable would hold such a position, though, right? Well, no. Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, has stated exactly that. Not only does she want no new nuclear power plants, but she has committed Germany to shut down all of its existing nuclear power plants by the year 2022. In fact, the Germans have already shut down 8 of their nuclear power plants. Before the Fukushima disaster, roughly 1/4 of Germany's power came from nuclear. So Germany is now faced with the prospect of replacing 25% of its energy production in only 11 years. More if Germany's power usage continues to grow, as it almost certainly will. And that is a problem. The best case scenario here is that this spurs a massive development of renewable energy. This really would be an unprecedented deployment. It would require massive investment and a commitment that few, if any, governments possess. But even if we are lucky and that best-case scenario comes to pass, it is still bad news. The problem with replacing nuclear with, say, solar, for instance, is that emissions are not really reduced. You are replacing one form of carbon-free energy with another. So all that massive investment and deployment won't reduce Germany's emissions because Germany won't be replacing its dirty coal power plants, and thus will still be burning massive amounts of coal. And that's the best case scenario. More likely is that Germany will not be able to replace all its nuclear powers with renewables, and that means more coal and natural gas power plants. In other words, more emissions, or exactly the opposite of what we desperately need. So Germany's current plan, at best, is a massive amount of work to keep emissions the same, but more likely a massive amount of work that will end up increasing emissions. Instead of replacing its nuclear power plants, Germany and every single other country should focus its efforts on phasing out coal and other forms of dirty energy as quickly as possible. If other countries follow Germany off the cliff of sane energy policy, according to the International Energy Agency, we can expect a 30% increase in emissions. Or in other words, very, very bad news for everyone. Okay, there's more to say about nuclear power. Mainly, that the nuclear industry and the government are definitely not helping nuclear's case. An investigation by the Associated Press has found that federal regulators in the United States have been working closely with the nuclear power industry to keep the nation's aging reactors operating within safety standards by repeatedly weakening those standards or simply failing to enforce them. Over and over again, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has decided that the original safety standards were too strict and has repeatedly weakened them. As the Associated Press reports, when valves leaked, more leakage was allowed, up to 20 times the original limit. When rampant cracking caused radioactive leaks from steam generator tubing, an easier test of the tubes was devised so that the plants could meet the standards. Failed cables, busted seals, broken nozzles, clogged screens, cracked concrete, dented containers, corroded metals, and rusty underground pipes. Nothing to see here, move along, nothing to worry about with radioactive leaks or leaky valves. At least, that is what the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission claims, despite the fact that not a single official body in government or industry has studied the overall frequency and potential impact of safety on such breakdowns in recent years. Even as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has extended the licenses of dozens of reactors. The public already views nuclear with an irrational fear. So all of this will only increase the cause to shut down all nuclear reactors, even in cases when the reactors are truly safe. But let's be clear on what this means. First of all, it doesn't mean we should panic. While the report looks very bad, and is very bad, I really do not think that the relaxed safety standards will lead to a meltdown. Not on their own, anyway, but combine lax standards with a natural disaster, like, say, a flood, and the situation becomes much more worrisome. But even then, we shouldn't panic. Currently, the Calhoun Nuclear Power Plant is under 2 feet of water thanks to a very swollen Mississippi River. But the situation looks to be under control. The plant was shut down for refueling before being inundated, and the flood has not yet affected the reactor nor the spent fuel rods. So far, the threat was that the nuclear plant had to rely on backup power for about 12 hours when one of the berms holding back the flood waters failed. Currently, the flood waters are 2.5 feet deep, but the Calhoun plant can sustain levels up to 10 feet deep, and the flood waters are supposed to crest at 4 feet deep. So this is a potentially bad situation. The key word there being potentially. Right now, things are, at the nuclear plant, safe. And aside from some undoubtedly busy plant operators, there isn't any real danger. So don't panic, but maybe keep an eye on the situation. In Scotland and Israel, massive swarms of jellyfish have forced the shutdown of nuclear power plants. It turns out that the swarms were so thick that operators were afraid the creatures would obstruct the flow of seawater used for cooling the reactors. That's a whole lot of jellyfish. And again, I need to remind everyone not to panic. There is no danger here, and the plants are not in trouble. They were shut down safely as a precautionary measure. So what does all of this have to do with global warming? Nothing, really. But it may have something to do with CO2 emissions. Those emissions make the ocean more acidic, and that acidity is causing drastic changes in ocean ecosystems. One change that has been predicted is a large increase in jellyfish numbers. Is that what we're seeing now? I have no idea. We have already spent a whole lot of time talking about renewable energy in past episodes, so I won't go into much detail on the IPCC report on the subject. They basically ran many different scenarios, one of them which stated that up to 77% of our energy could be produced from renewable sources by 2050. And that's where the trouble starts. Not real trouble, mind you, just another manufactured controversy. You see, the scenario that claimed we could get that 77% came from Greenpeace. It was one of many scenarios considered by this IPCC report, but it was highlighted in the press release. Hence, all the stories a few weeks ago stating that we could get up to 80% of renewables by the year 2050. Now, one could nitpick about the press release, and one probably should. It failed to properly explain that the 80% number in the press release, 77% in the actual report, was only from one scenario, and that that scenario made some politically unrealistic assumptions. Nothing likely technologically or economically unfeasible, just politically untenable. But political feasibility wasn't really in the scope of this report. So one could quite reasonably criticize the IPCC press office, which, it needs to be stressed, is separate from the Working Group 3, which wrote the report. The report itself is on a firm technical footing. It is sound. If people were reasonable, this would be the end of it. Some criticisms of the press office, but an evaluation of the report on the merits of the report itself, not on the press release. But we all know there are more than a few unreasonable people in the climate debate. See, it turns out that not only did the IPCC use a scenario from Greenpeace, one that arrives at similar conclusions to others in the peer-reviewed literature, but one of the authors of the report was also from Greenpeace. This has led calls to the entire Working Group 3 of the IPCC to be disbanded. How dare they allow someone from an environmental NGO to be an author on a report? Surely the entire report and everyone involved in its creation has now been corrupted. Okay, calm down. Once you step off the ledge, you might realize that experts reside in all sorts of places. It is true that most do reside in academia, but some experts end up at places like Greenpeace. Others end up working in industry, perhaps even at an oil company. And shouldn't the IPCC be allowed to seek out experts working at oil companies? Of course they should. And they did. Three experts who helped write the reports came from Chevron, one from the Petroleum Corporation of Jamaica, and one from a mining company. yet no one has called for the Working Group 3 of the IPCC to be disbanded because of those industry experts. Nor should they. That would be insane. I prefer to ask large, reputable institutions to disband only after I have substantive evidence. But such evidence just doesn't exist. The IPCC is a reputable organization, and those who attack it have no evidence to the contrary. Hence, the superficial double standards and vague innuendo, and an utter lack of anything even vaguely resembling substance.
What's the price of a gallon of gasoline? In the U.S., it's about $3 or $4. But some experts say the true costs of that gallon are much higher. What about all the invisible costs of using gasoline? Who pays for those? In Germany, a gallon costs more than $8. In Switzerland, about $6. What are they paying for that we're not? Even if we don't pay at the pump, we all pay in the long term. So how does pollution translate into dollars? We looked at a single gallon of gasoline refined and consumed in California. It produces about 25 pounds of greenhouse gas pollution, about the same weight as a Cocker Spaniel. Many of us have to rely on our cars every day. American drivers each use an average of 557 gallons of gasoline a year. Multiply that by about 238 million cars and trucks. It's a lot of Cocker Spaniels. A single driver creates about 10,000 pounds of greenhouse gas pollution every year. It takes 1 acre of forest to absorb that pollution. For all U.S. drivers combined, it takes a forest roughly the size of California, Nevada, and Arizona each year. So, where does all that pollution come from, and who's responsible? Actually, the pollution begins the moment crude oil is pumped up from underground. We followed 1 gallon of gasoline from Saudi Arabia, where Americans get 12% of our imported oil. This crude oil is pumped into giant oil tankers. The largest hold up to 2 million barrels. This releases about 2 pounds of greenhouse gases for every gallon of gasoline. Then the tankers begin their 11,000-mile journey to California. When the crude reaches the California refinery, it's mixed with oil from other places. Here the oil is heated, filtered, and burned to make fuels and other products. For every gallon you get at the pump, about 3.5 pounds of greenhouse gases were created at the refinery. Then the gasoline goes to your local station. On average, a diesel tanker travels 50 miles to deliver its cargo. While the tanker truck driver refills the storage tanks, gas evaporates. And it's not just greenhouse gases. Other pollutants, like benzene, are really bad for your health. That's what you smell when you pull into the station. When you pull up and unscrew the gas cap, more gas evaporates, more pollution. You lift the nozzle. See those wavy lines coming from the pump? Toxic chemicals and smog-forming gases. Then you turn the ignition. And when your car is hot, gas can evaporate straight through the metal without even being burned. On a hot day, even when the car is off. How much pollution you create when driving depends on the kind of car you drive, the kind of gas you use, how you drive, tune-ups, traffic, even the weather. So, the total amount of pollution created by the driver is highly variable. But on average, it's more than 19 pounds of greenhouse gas pollution per gallon. That's 3/4 of the total pollution. But what about the other costs of refining and using gasoline, like oil spills, water pollution from storage tanks, even reduced crop yields, and respiratory illnesses like asthma? Economists call these impacts externalities. It means costs borne by society that are not included in the price. For example, many low-income and minority groups live near highways, refineries, rail, and shipyards. They suffer more from asthma and other respiratory illnesses. In LA, the cost of air pollution adds up to more than $1,250 per person per year because of ER visits, lost work days, missed school days, even death. One study estimates these external costs range from $550 billion to almost $1.7 trillion per year, just for the U.S. Add this to the price we pay at the pump, you're looking at up to $15 per gallon. Remember Germany's $8 a gallon gas? What are they actually paying for? They created an ecotax on gas, about $1 a gallon. Those funds go towards social programs and renewable energy. It's something, but really, just a drop in the bucket. What is the true price of gas? It's a lot more than we pay at the pump.
That clip comes from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Now, of course, the same applies for coal. More so, actually, because coal pollutes far more than gasoline. The fact is that thanks to negative externalities, the price of fossil fuels is artificially low. And that is why we use so much fossil fuels, and why clean energy has a hard time catching on. But as the clip I just played explains, despite the fact that the price at the pump for gas is artificially low, we all end up paying the true cost eventually. Which is precisely why some economists call global warming the greatest market failure the world has ever seen. And that is why I am such a strong proponent of policies like a carbon tax. A carbon tax is the simplest, most transparent way to internalize the costs of burning fossil fuels and force us to pay the true cost up front. It allows the free market to function properly and to avoid our current market failure. Recently, the International Energy Agency released an evaluation of humanity's carbon budget for 2010, and the news was not good. Despite a decrease in emissions in 2009 due to the economic slowdown, emissions in 2010 rose to record-breaking levels. According to its analysis, 2010 saw humanity emit roughly 30.6 gigatons of CO2, up 5% over 2008. Industrialized countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development still account for 40% of all emissions, but only 25% of emissions growth. Developing countries like India and China are seeing CO2 output rise at a much faster pace, although their per capita emissions remain relatively low. In fact, the current release of CO2 is almost 10 times higher than the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, or PETM, that occurred 55 million years ago. Why does this matter? It matters because the PETM is the event in the paleoclimate record that most closely matches what we are currently doing to Earth's atmosphere. During the PETM, a massive release of CO2 into the atmosphere increased temperatures by 5 to 8 degrees Celsius. The temperatures remained this high for roughly 100,000 years. In the oceans, the massive release of CO2 caused the oceans to become much more acidic, which resulted in a large extinction event. And the current rates of ocean acidifications are also about 10 times higher than they were during the PETM. Determining exactly what the effects of such an increase in temperatures and increase in ocean acidity were back then, of course, isn't easy. But it doesn't take much of an imagination to see that whatever the exact effects might have been, had our civilization been around at the time, it would have been disastrous. And currently, we are pumping 10 times as much CO2 into the atmosphere than during the PETM, with no signs of stopping. Are you alarmed yet? No, you're not alarmed yet? Could it be because you heard of the upcoming ice age? If you have heard of this ice age, don't worry. Peter Hadfield, aka Potholer54 on YouTube, will set you straight.
Guess what? The Earth is facing a mini ice age within 10 years.
Well, Rush is right about one thing. This is a guess. I was going to put the next Golden Crocoduck nominee into this slot, but I find that instead I have to whack another unscientific myth back into its hole, something that, of course, has gone viral on the internet. We're headed for a mini ice age. Who says so? Well, scientists do. I have that on good authority, because here's the Daily Mail telling us we face a mini ice age within 10 years because of a drop in sunspot activity, and in the very second line the Daily Mail tells us this claim comes from scientists. So since we now know this comes from scientists, we don't really need to read the article. Oh, all right, if you insist. I'll read through it so I can get the names of these scientists for all you skeptics out there. Frank Hill of the NSO, a scientist, says the solar cycle may be going into some sort of hiatus. Okay, nothing about a mini ice age there. But Dr. Richard Altrock, also a scientist, says the sun may be going into some sort of state from which it may take a long time to recover. Okay, still no mini ice age. Experts, not named, say the sun has been unusually quiet for about 4 years. Well, that's well known, but still nothing about a mini ice age. And David Hathaway, a scientist from NASA, predicts that this cycle will turn out to be the weakest in a century. No mini ice age. Scientist Matt Penn of the NSO says solar magnetic fields which cause sunspots have been decreasing since 1998. Okay, that's in all the scientific literature, but what happened to this mini ice age? We have 4 named scientists and a number of unnamed experts, all telling us we may be in for an unusual hiatus in sunspot activity, but not one of them supports the headline that we may be headed for a mini ice age. The headline is, of course, the conclusion of scientists at the Daily Mail. Limbo and the Mail weren't the only ones to pull this hypothesis out of thin air. It's official, wrote James Dellingpole in the Daily Telegraph. A new ice age is on its way. It's official? Well, which official body announced it? No one who was quoted in the article. Dellingpole, the man who's right about everything, apparently, simply copied and pasted what he read on internet blogs and then embellished it. Fox News even called this made-up mini ice age the science story of the century. And the way from the mainstream media, the internet blogs were on fire. Something called the Global Warming Policy Foundation, sounds important, not only said the Earth may be headed for a mini ice age within the next 10 years, but that announcement had come from scientists at the US National Solar Observatory. What? All right, I've fed these silly media organizations enough rope. Now let's pull it in and hang them by their balls. We'll start by wading through all this bullshit and trying to find an actual source. In fact, this media paroxysm all started with a paper at the 2011 annual meeting of the Solar Physics Division of the American Astronomical Society. Interesting how government researchers are corrupt liars when they say the Earth is warming, but the model of integrity when they're thought to be suggesting that the Earth is cooling. Based on the text the media used, their speculation seems to be based on an NSO press release that accompanied the paper. Nowhere does it say we're headed for a mini ice age. The closest any of the media organizations got to admitting that the entire mini ice age story was based on their own speculation was when Frank Hill, lead author of the paper, said he wouldn't discuss the effects of a quiet sun on temperature or global warming. Ooh, conspiracy! Keeping secrets! Hiding the truth! No, it's just that he's a solar physicist, not a climatologist. And neither the Mail nor any of the other media organizations bothered to talk to a climate scientist to see what the repercussions might be. In fact, all they had to do was spend 5 minutes searching through the scientific literature, and they would have come across this paper by Fulner and Ramstorff, published last year. A slowdown of solar activity has been discussed for some time because of the lack of sunspots over the last 4 years. Fulner and Ramsdorff calculated that another period of low solar activity, equivalent to the Maunder minimum, would result in global cooling of no more than 0.3 degrees centigrade. But that has to be set against the expected rise in temperatures due to a doubling of CO2 from pre-industrial levels, expected to be between 2.5 and 4 degrees centigrade. Why didn't any of the media organizations bother to check the scientific literature? Okay, stupid question. And there's something else that gives away the fact that raging hormones are driving this story rather than brain cells. These journalists and bloggers seem so convinced that global warming is a scam, they never even considered that carbon dioxide could overcome this predicted cooling. Instead, they seem to think that solar cycles drive everything and spewed the most ludicrous nonsense about how this exposed the whole carbon dioxide global warming agenda. Their fingers have been on the trigger for so long, waiting for evidence to shoot holes in climate science, that the merest hint of a slowdown in solar activity is enough to make them fire off both barrels. "Scientists try to have it both ways on global warming," was the headline in the blog New American. But leaving aside that this prediction of a mini ice age comes entirely from the media, there's only one way scientists have it on long-term climate change, and that's been repeated ad nauseam in their research papers and on my channel, that long-term temperature changes are driven by solar irradiance and carbon dioxide levels. Whether solar activity increases or decreases in the future, it still follows this formula. Frank Hill obviously got so fed up with all this media speculation that he added a paragraph to the NSO press release specifically stating that he was not predicting another mini ice age, and he repeated Fulner and Ramstorff's estimate of 0.3 degrees for the net cooling effect of a slowdown in solar activity. Will Hill's statement make a difference to those who are now telling us to expect a mini ice age? Of course not. Haven't you been paying attention? This is the science story of the century!
Okay, so now we know that the Earth is warming, and there is no ice age imminent. But there are still some people who simply refuse to accept those undeniable facts. And when scientists stand up and defend their science, those same people are busy denying the undeniable and sinking to new lows. The first step is to harass scientists by abusing one of the fundamental tools that allows citizens to peek into the innards of government bureaucracies, Freedom of Information Acts. The Washington Post, which itself has published more than its fair share of climate misinformation, has a great article on these abuses. It states, "Freedom of information laws are critical tools that allow Americans to see what their leaders do on their behalf. But some global warming skeptics in Virginia are showing that even the best tools can be misused. Lawyers from the Environmental Law Center at the American Tradition Institute have asked the University of Virginia to turn over thousands of emails and other documents written by Michael Mann, a former University of Virginia professor and a prominent climate scientist. Another warming skeptic, Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, who we have discussed here on A Regular Climate before, recently demanded many of the same documents to determine whether Mr. Mann somehow defrauded taxpayers when he obtained research grants to study global warming. Going after Michael Mann only discourages the sort of scientific inquiry that, over time, sorts out fact from speculation. Good science from bad. Academics must feel comfortable sharing research, disagreeing with colleagues, and proposing conclusions, not all of which will be correct, without fear that those who dislike their findings will conduct invasive fishing expeditions in search of a pretext to discredit them. That give and take should be unhindered by how popular a professor's ideas are or whose ideological convictions might be hurt." That is a strong statement from the Washington Post. And if any such documents are released, you can be sure that any slight imperfection on the part of scientists will be blown out of all proportion. As Tim at the website Balloon Juice said in the wake of the ClimateGate pseudo-scandal, "Science works fine in aggregate. But this idea that science must have only flawless people doing impeccable work is a straw man set up by the superstitious to discredit empiricism through nitpicking. That scientists are flawed humans like the rest of us should come as a surprise to no one." But of course, Virginia is not the only place this type of abuse is occurring. The scientists at the University of East Anglia's Climatic Research Unit were flooded with so many Freedom of Information requests that were they to have responded to them, it would have taken so long they would have been completely unable to do the scientific research which they are paid to do. So in the end, they were stuck between a rock and a hard place. Either they could stop doing their job and spend untold hours responding to their requests, or they could ignore them altogether. Neither option is really acceptable, but the fact is that most academic institutions are utterly unable to deal with such requests. They have neither the manpower nor the infrastructure to do so. And why should they? In the world of academia, such requests have no place. For hundreds of years, science has done just fine without any freedom of information laws. Scientists have no trouble replicating the work of other scientists. And every scientist has great incentive to have their work replicated, because a scientific result that no one can replicate is of very little value to anyone. Replication is the main reason we have confidence in scientific findings. No replication, no confidence. But harassment via freedom of information requests is only the mildest form of harassment, hurled at people who stand up and defend mainstream climate science. For example, in a recent talk, Lord Monckton, one of the most famous, or should I say infamous, deniers out there, compared statements made by Adolf Hitler to statements made by Russ Garneau, the chief advisor to the Australian government on climate issues. And what was Garneau's offending statement? Well, he had the temerity to state that non-experts have no rational choice but to accept that mainstream science is likely correct. According to Monckton, this is a fascist point of view. That non-experts accept the conclusions of experts is fascism? That is the height of absurdity. If I get cancer, I will rely on the opinion of experts. In this case, doctors, or more specifically, oncologists. I could, of course, decide to ignore my doctor's advice, but my chance of survival would be greatly diminished if I did. That would be an irrational choice. Rational people understand that expertise matters, and that not everyone's opinion is equally valid. Perhaps Monckton should look up the definition of fascism.
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
And this isn't even the first time Monckton has descended to calling people Nazis. During the Copenhagen climate talks in 2009, Monckton called a group of young protesters the Hitler Youth. And when one of those protesters mentioned that he himself was Jewish, Monckton refused to apologize and repeated the insult.
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
Monckton has since apologized to Russ Garneau, but not to the young Jewish protester. Of course, people who like Monckton's denial of mainstream climate science continue to take him seriously despite these outrageous claims. And calling people Nazis isn't even the only absurd claim in his repertoire. He has a very long and diverse record of absurd claims, like his claim from the late 80s that he wanted to quarantine everyone with AIDS, or that he believes President Obama probably isn't a U.S. citizen, and alleging that NASA purposefully crashed their own carbon dioxide monitoring satellite into the Pacific Ocean, and claiming to be developing a drug that would cure not only Graves' disease, which Monckton has, but also multiple sclerosis and HIV, influenza, and even the common cold. Or, in other words, the quintessential snake oil. Monckton also claims that he's a member of the UK House of Lords, even though the House of Lords says that Monckton is not and has never been a member. Yet people persist in taking this clown seriously. Okay, all of that is bad enough, but it gets worse. It should surprise no one that if you spend your time labeling scientists as Nazis and other such vile labels, it's only a matter of time before someone takes the next step, which is threats of violence. Emails threatening violence are now commonplace, as are threatening phone calls threatening to attack the academics in the street if they continue their research. And when your place of work is public knowledge, these threats are downright terrifying. One scientist had a dead animal dumped on his doorstep and now travels with bodyguards. Already, many universities have been forced to upgrade security to protect scientists. Names and numbers have been deleted from staff directories. One scientist's office cannot be found without photo identification and an official escort. Another has had a panic button installed on the advice of police. In Australia, the Australian National University has confirmed that it moved several high-profile climate scientists, economists, and policy researchers into more secure buildings, following explicit threats to these researchers. More than 30 researchers across Australia, ranging from ecologists and environmental policy experts to meteorologists and atmospheric physicists, have said they are receiving a stream of abusive emails threatening violence, sexual assault, public smear campaigns, and attacks on their family members. This is beyond disgusting, but it should surprise no one given that people like Monckton are calling these scientists Nazis. It is time for everyone to wake up and realize what an utter lack of credibility the denial movement has. Their tactics are nothing short of disgusting. Up next, we have Dana Nucciatelli, who is a writer for SkepticalScience.com, and he's going to tell us about John Christie. Hi, Dana.
Hey, Dan.
So, who's John Christie?
John Christie is a climate scientist out of the University of Alabama at Huntsville. He's one of the handful of climate scientists who are actually skeptical of man-made global warming, or at least the degree of man-made global warming. He doesn't dispute that we're increasing the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, or that that's going to cause some global warming, but he disputes how much that's causing and how much it'll cause in the future. So he and Roy Spencer is also at Alabama, Huntsville, and then there's Richard Lindzen at MIT. Those are the three kind of most prominent climate scientist skeptics.
Right. And just, I guess, as background, should point out that several surveys of the climate science community have been done, and they show that roughly 97% of climate scientists accept that we are causing global warming, and about 3%, of which John Christie is one of those people, are still not convinced. So he really is an outlier in the minority with his position on climate change.
Right. There's been direct surveys of climate scientists, and there's also been surveys of the peer-reviewed literature looking over different climate science studies in peer-reviewed journals, finding very few climate scientist skeptics like Christie and Lindzen and Spencer were actually publishing skeptical peer-reviewed articles in journals.
Right.
So there's a couple different ways we know that this consensus exists.
Right. And actually, one of the really useful things that John Christie provides and the other dissenting scientists is they are kind of proof positive that you can have a dissenting view and you still get to keep your job.
That's right.
You still get to publish in the peer-reviewed literature if your papers are good. They meet that minimum standard. So there isn't this global conspiracy that if you speak out against global warming, you're shut down and you're fired and you're shipped off to Siberia. It's all, John Christie works as a climate scientist.
There's also this big conspiracy that the skeptics can't get research funding, they can't get government research grants because only the alarmists can get the research grants, but Christie and Spencer and Lindzen, they have no problem getting government research grants at the same time.
Right. So it's nice to have him there. But so what kind of arguments does he make? What does he say?
Well, he sort of starts off from the position of overemphasizing what we don't know. He says, one of his arguments is that we don't know very much more about the climate than we did in the 1970s, that our gaps in understanding of the climate is just huge. And so therefore, what he says is we're jumping to conclusions and blaming most of the global warming on humans. So that's sort of his starting point.
So that we really don't know what we're talking about.
Pretty much. I mean, it's pretty much just that, he's basically arguing there's a lot that we don't know, and therefore we can't blame it on humans, or at least we don't know how much we can blame on humans. So then from that point, he argues that the warming could just be internal variability, which is basically heat moving around from the oceans to the air, And so it's not actually greenhouse gases that are causing the warming. The warming is being transferred from the deep oceans to the surface, and that's why we're seeing the warming on the surface. It's just that it's coming from a different part of the climate.
Right.
And there's a little more subtlety to the internal variability, but that's sort of the main gist of it. And, I mean, the flaw with that argument is that we have measurements of the ocean, too, and oceans are also warming, so that's kind of the Achilles.
Right. The oceans, as I understand it, are warming. We have a profile of how they're warming, and they're warming from the surface down.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much right, yeah. And the deep oceans are warming as well, but they're probably not warming as much as the surface.
Right. That's right. And the other thing, this was all written up in the Conversation site, which is the conversation.edu.au, which is an interesting site run by a bunch of academics. And they talked about the warming from the ocean issue a bit in one of their articles recently. And they said the other thing is that the continents are warming faster than the oceans.
That's also true.
So if you would expect the oceans to be the source of the warming, the continents would lag behind that. The oceans would warm first, and the continents would warm after. But what we're getting is the continents are warming, and the oceans are warming slower.
Right.
So that that just points to the fact that the oceans are not the source.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, I mean, Roy Spencer has a slightly different sort of, he calls it the internal radiative forcing hypothesis, which is different. It's sort of a different internal variability argument where he thinks ocean changes are causing cloud cover changes, and that's causing more solar radiation to hit the surface, and that's what's causing the warming. So he's got a slightly different internal variability argument that's it's a little harder to disprove, but the warming coming from the oceans is clearly not the case.
Right. So he says we don't know anything about the climate, but the climate is warming because of the oceans.
Yeah, that's, at least you would say that's another possibility, so therefore we shouldn't just jump to conclusions and blame it on humans, because it could be this. He's more convinced about the internal variability hypothesis.
Right, okay. Now, but there are a lot of fingerprints that point to the fact that it's greenhouse gas emissions that are causing the warming.
Right, that's another Christie.
I mean, we talked about the reasons why the oceans are probably not causing the warming, but does Christie have an explanation for why the stratosphere is cooling? Because that is one of the key indicators of greenhouse gas-driven warming versus other factors.
Yeah, I haven't heard one. I mean, every so often you'll hear that the skeptics say it's just ozone because ozone depletion, I mean, ozone's a greenhouse gas, and so ozone depletion, that can interfere, or that can, have an effect on how much the stratosphere is warming or cooling. So that makes the stratosphere a little tricky, but the problem with that is that the higher layers of the atmosphere are also cooling, which doesn't play a role there. And so I haven't heard a skeptic argument, including from Christie, to explain how the whole upper atmosphere could cooling if it's not greenhouse gases, if it's internal variability or something else like that. It's really hard to explain without greenhouse gases.
All right. And now, how does he discount the warming effect of CO2? Because that's basic physics.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. So a key, sort of the most important argument for all these skeptics is that climate sensitivity is low. So climate sensitivity tells you how much the planet's going to warm in response to any change in the amount of the energy imbalance,
right,
including greenhouse gas changes.
So basically, how sensitive the climate is to being forced in one way, warming, or another way, cooling.
Exactly. And so, we know that there's this large energy imbalance from the increase in greenhouse gases. And so the only way you can argue that that's not having a major warming effect is if the climate just isn't very sensitive to it. And so that's the key argument for, Lindzen, Spencer, Christie, all these guys, they all argue climate sensitivity is really low.
So how do they explain the ice ages is always my question when someone says climate sensitivity is low.
Yeah, that's kind of that's also the Achilles heel of the sensitivity is low argument, because, there's a big temperature change between ice ages and now. It's like 5 degrees Celsius.
Right.
And so in the energy imbalance, the radiative forcing from between those periods, it's big, but it's not so big that you can explain it if climate sensitivity is low. I mean, the lower climate sensitivity is, the larger radiative force if you need to explain that big temperature change.
Right.
So saying sensitivity is really low, I mean, you need a really big radiative force to explain it, and we don't see that in the records.
Exactly, yeah. John Christie is a natural climate scientist, so he does get a lot of attention, I guess.
A lot, yes.
I guess when there's just a few climate scientists who say that climate is not warming, the people who want to pick from, you want to make sure they present both sides of the story, or whatever, who want a dissenting voice with some credibility, turn to Christie.
Yeah.
So I guess he's probably overrepresented in the media.
Most definitely. I mean, not too long ago, a few months ago, he testified before Congress. The Republicans called him to testify before U.S. Congress. And then a few months later, he was on an Australian talk show, or maybe even a Canadian, he was on an Australian talk show and a Canadian radio show.
Right.
The Canadian one was actually the CBC. I guess that was the
yeah,
most recent.
I think that was on The Current, which is pretty good, and the host of that, she does a good job of, she does kind of get both sides, but she does a good job of kind of putting both sides in perspective.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad show. It was just they were talking about extreme weather, since we've had so much extreme weather this year.
Right.
So, you know, Christie was sort of the dissenting opinion. His opinion is that the extreme weather we're seeing isn't outside of natural variability, of course. And so that was the position he represented in the interview.
Right. Well, we talked a lot about extreme weather last episode, and extreme weather is always a tricky one because it's not, I mean, it can't be, you know, a single tornado can't be attributed to climate change, but
exactly.
We're seeing a lot of crazy weather. Some people have called this global weirdening or something.
Yeah, I think that was the title of the radio show, actually.
I think I may have listened to it a while back, actually. So, but yeah, I mean, basically there's more crazy weather than there should be.
Right.
We're seeing, you know, lots of very extreme flooding, lots of heat waves, lots of tornadoes, lots of storms. So something is probably not right, but doing statistics on kind of rare events is tricky.
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, all you can say is that as the planet keeps warming, this kind of thing is going to become more frequent, more likely to happen. But, you know, it becomes tricky actually saying this is happening because of climate change, because it's just averages.
I mean, there has always been floods, heat waves, and tornadoes, but maybe not as much.
Sure, exactly.
Now, one thing I noticed looking through the list of arguments is that Christie does tend to kind of move away from climate science and move into, I guess, what you could call climate economics, saying that it's too expensive and you know, we just can't limit CO2.
Right. He says that his sort of justification for talking about climate economics is that he's the Alabama state climatologist, and I'm not sure exactly how being a state climatologist gets you into economics, but somehow he thinks that makes him qualified to talk on the subject. I mean, I don't really know exactly what a state climatologist does, but I guess maybe they have some economic influence.
But something I've posted on the blogs that generally economists are all on the side of, you know, it's not talked about much, but there's a consensus of science, but there's also a consensus among economists that cutting emissions is a sensible thing to do. And they, of course, have opinions on how to do it. But that it makes sense to cut emissions. And one of the things that they said I think is very interesting is that the uncertainty that remains actually makes cutting emissions, makes it more important to cut emissions rather than less important, because, of course, uncertainty cuts both ways. So when people like Christie talk about uncertainty, they seem to almost assume that it means warming could be less. Which is true, but it could be more. And because kind of the cost curve of how much it will cost to deal with climate change doesn't increase linearly, it increases exponentially, a little bit more warming than we from what we expected means a lot more cost. A little right. bit less means a little bit less cost. So the economist argument, and this has been there's been a few surveys of economists, and they tend to agree with this, is that the uncertainty that remains in regards to climate sensitivity and how much we can expect the world to warm means is an argument for acting instead of an argument against action. So I think that kind of cuts down Christie's argument that we really don't know enough to act quite substantially.
Yeah, that's a big contradiction, that when you're arguing that the uncertainty is high, I mean, you're also saying that we can't rule out the worst consequences, and so, you know, the cost could be just really huge if we don't do anything. And so arguing for uncertainty isn't the same thing as arguing that we shouldn't do anything. But Christie right. also argues that we shouldn't do anything, and so he's kind of contradicting himself pretty badly there.
Right. And again, we should emphasize that he is kind of out of the mainstream. His opinions are outliers, and 97%, roughly 97% of climate scientists don't agree with him, with his view of the situation.
Yeah, it's something like over 90% of economists think we should cut greenhouse gas emissions too and put a price on carbon. Right. So he's outside of the mainstream on both the science and on the economics.
Right, and I think that's the that's what the kind of the takeaway point is that even though he is a climate scientist, we have to understand that his opinion is well outside the mainstream. I mean, if you go to the doctor, there are doctors who are prescribing all sorts of wacky treatment, all sort of alternative medicine that haven't been shown to do anything, but they're real doctors. So in any discipline, there are going to be outliers, and even just because he is a climate scientist doesn't mean we listen to him. It's better to get kind of an overview of what the consensus in the field is, and the consensus is quite clear that the Earth is warming,
right.
that we are the cause, and that it's very bad.
Yeah, I mean, the reason he's an outlier is because his arguments just aren't supported by scientific evidence.
Right.
So maybe he's convinced by his arguments, but it's hard to convince other scientists when you're not supported by the evidence.
Right.
That's why the consensus is on the other side.
Exactly. I mean, I know John Cook always likes to say there's a consensus among scientists because there's a consensus of evidence.
Exactly.
And the evidence really does point to the fact that John Christie is almost certainly wrong.
Yes.
Well, thanks for this interview. I hope our listeners will know a little bit more about John Christie, because his name does pop up fairly frequently.
Yes.
And he is one of the few people that I might generally call skeptical, because he is an actual scientist, although his arguments do fall apart under a closer examination. And you can actually get to all of the argument and the whole Christie Crocs page by going to sks.to/Christie, CHRISTY. That'll take you to the whole Christie Crocs section on the Skeptical Science site. And there is lots of good stuff here.
Thanks.
So good job on putting all this together. It's really useful to have a nice concise page for kind of the more prominent deniers out there, or in this case skeptics. You can easily quickly kind of pull up the information and get the links as to why the arguments don't really make sense.
Yeah, that's what we're going for. We're trying to build sort of a go-to one-stop resource where you can debunk all of their myths really easily.
And you guys are doing a great job. So again, I encourage all my listeners to go to skepticalscience.com and read the whole site, top to bottom. It's great.
Thanks.
And while you're at it, I just got my copy of Climate Change Denial, Heads in the Sand.
Very cool.
So again, to my listeners, we talked about this last week with John Cook, but this is a book he and Hayden Washington wrote. So again, go out, buy the book. Don't think there's a Kindle version available yet, but you
Not
can
yet.
Buy the Kindle version when that comes out too.
That's right.
Anyway, so thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks for having me.
It looks like Canada frustrated many in the international community when it announced at the climate talks in Bonn, Germany, that it would not support an extended Kyoto Protocol after 2012. This should come as a surprise to no one. Canada's stated position on climate is to do nothing until the United States enacts a climate policy. The United States isn't part of the current Kyoto Protocol and won't be part of the extended protocol either. So neither will Canada. But unlike many, I don't see this as a big deal. The fact is that the current Kyoto Protocol has done nothing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Remember, they are at an all-time record-breaking high right now. So extending a failed international treaty into the future isn't likely to do anything for our emissions. The current path at the UN to reduce greenhouse gas emissions has failed miserably. Perhaps now that the extended Kyoto Protocol is now dead pretty much everywhere but inside the European Union, the UN climate talks can move forward. Irony alert. Behold Roy Spencer, who, as previously mentioned, is one of the only real climatologists who is skeptical of global warming. Recently, this is what he wrote in reply to a comment on his blog. He said, "I view my job a little like a legislator, supported by the taxpayer to protect the interests of the taxpayer and to minimize the role of government." Now, Roy Spencer's work is funded by the federal government, so it's funny to see him preach free market fundamentalism when his career was built on federal money. But that irony isn't why I am bringing this to your attention. Look at Roy Spencer's answer, or more specifically, look at what he didn't say. He didn't mention that his job is to provide the best science he can for the taxpayers to pay his salary. It seems his motivation is something more than just the science. But that isn't all the irony. Arch-denier Senator Inhofe has had to skip out on the latest denier conference because he is under the weather, just as his home state of Oklahoma is being slammed by a record-smashing heat wave and drought more severe than that of the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. It looks like not just Inhofe is under the weather, but his whole state is under the weather. Too bad Senator Inhofe has his head so far up his denial that he can't savor this delicious irony. That's it for this episode. As always, links and additional good stuff will be posted at irregularclimate.com. Also at the website, we have plenty of RSS feeds for subscribing to the podcast. We're also available in the iTunes Music Store and the Zune Marketplace. And we're social. We have links to our Twitter and Facebook pages. Follow us and send us feedback. There's also an awesome blog, so go check it out. And if you feel so inclined and want to support the podcast, you can donate to Irregular Climate via PayPal. The links are also on the website. I am Dan Mutal. You can follow me online at ofdan.ca, where you can see links to my blog, my Twitter feed, my Flickr feed, and everything else I do online, like my photography website, Eye of Dan. Thanks, and until next time, try and stay regular.